Thanks, Mark, for that gracious introduction. Actually, it goes well with my remarks here, because I'll just start. I find myself in a curious position. I travel the world from Montevideo to Marrakesh, from Warsaw to Washington, and from Los Angeles to Louisville in the last month, to offer a social scientific perspective on the family. I rely upon large-scale surveys, sophisticated statistical models, and peer-reviewed studies to convey important truths about marriage and family life. But virtually everything that I have to say is what would have been considered common sense by my grandparents. So I'm in the business of using elaborate scientific methods to prove grandma right. Okay, so go to the next slide here. Yet every day we seem to be less and less inclined to listen to the wisdom of grandma. Take California this past August. At the beginning of that month, San Francisco Judge Vaughn Walker struck down California's marriage law and declared in his legal opinion that it's beyond, quote, any doubt that parents' genders are irrelevant to children's developmental outcomes, unquote. I think grandma would beg to differ. The silliness from California continued later in the month when Hollywood star Jennifer Aniston, who is now starring in a movie about a woman who uses a sperm donor to have a baby, said the following, quote, women are realizing that they don't have to settle with a man just to have that child, unquote. I don't think grandma would agree that having a sperm donor for a daddy is a good idea. I think more generally, these two quotes are indicative of kind of a new wisdom among our elites that's taking hold in much of the U.S. and indeed much of the West more generally. And this new elite wisdom holds that all kinds of families are just as good as the intact married family for kids, and that mothers and fathers do not make distinctive contributions to the emotional, social, and financial welfare of their children. You know, both basically moms and dads are fungible. Go to the next slide here. Now, regardless of this elite wisdom, a large and growing body of social science indicates that mothers and fathers bring distinctive talents to the parenting enterprise, that children are most likely to thrive and even survive when they're raised by both their own mother and father, and that kids long to know and be known. That is, they long to be known and be known by the man and the woman who brought them into this world. In other words, it's not just gender differences that matter for kids. It's also being in a relationship with their own biological father and mother. Let me now take you on a brief tour of the science regarding gender and parenthood to kind of elaborate on these ideas. Go to the next slide. So among the many distinctive talents that mothers bring to the parenting enterprise, a few stand out. One, their capacity to breastfeed. Two, their ability to understand their kids. Three, their ability to communicate with their children. And four, their ability to nurture their kids. Next slide, please. Now, obviously, only moms can breastfeed their kids. Of course, breastfeeding is time-consuming and in our contemporary world, often inconvenient. But most mothers find breastfeeding physically pleasurable and emotionally rewarding once they get past that first stage. And I say this from personal experience. Sort of spousal experience. And there are also clear health benefits for moms who breastfeed, such as a marked reduction in risk of breast cancer. And we also know that there's a vast literature on the effects of breastfeeding for kids. They're much less likely to come up with 15 serious maladies, from ear infections to sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, because of the various sugars, nutrients, and antibodies that are found in breast milk. I'd also add that it's important to just understand that breastfeeding helps to cement the biological foundations of a unique mother-child bond that lasts into and beyond adolescence. So clearly here, mothers have a very sex-specific advantage when it comes to parenting in this one domain. Go to the next slide, please. But when it comes to parenting, moms also build on this biological foundation to excel in interpreting the physical cues of their children. Mothers are more responsive to the distinctive cries of infants. They're better able than fathers, for instance, to distinguish between a cry of hunger and a cry of pain from their baby. They're also better than fathers at detecting the emotions of their children. by looking at their faces, postures, and gestures. One experiment found, for instance, that women are better than men at identifying infant emotions such as sadness, fear, surprise, or joy. Another study found that teenagers report that their mothers know them better and are more in tune with their moods compared to their fathers. Dr. Marianne Legato, who directs the Partnership for Gender-Specific Medicine at Columbia University in New York, believes that biology has primed women to read nonverbal cues of infants. She writes, quote, "Women have to be better at reading the subtle and nuanced language of human expression than men, so that they can better determine the needs of their highly dependent, wordless infants," unquote. And as kids age into adolescence, moms retain their advantage in understanding or in reading their children. So in sum, compared to dads, moms are better able to understand their children's actions and appearance to determine their emotional and physical state. Next slide here. Mothers also have an advantage when it comes to communicating with their children. They use more words and more descriptive words with their kids, on average, than do dads. And they can interpret the tone and content of their children's utterances better than men. And they remember what their children actually say better than do fathers. For instance, moms are better at detecting whether an ambiguous comment from a teen, "You and Dad sure seem concerned about my grades," is meant to be ironic, critical, or complimentary. Now, why is it that women have this advantage when it comes to communication? Well, there are a host of sociological reasons. There are also, we think, probably some biological reasons for this to be the case. First, women have more nerve cells in the left brain, which is the seat of our ability to process language. Second, women's left and right brains enjoy more connectivity than do men's. That is the corpus callosum, that is the network of fibers connecting the left and right brains, is larger in women's brains than in men's brains. Women also have more dopamine in the part of the brain responsible for language and memory skills. And dopamine is a chemical messenger that delivers information efficiently within the brain. So once again, as Dr. Marianne Legato says, quote, "The increased accessibility of these biological systems makes listening to, understanding, and producing speech easier for women," unquote. As someone who lives with one woman and four girls, I can attest to the truth of Dr. Legato's insight. Next slide here. Now, this maternal sensitivity to kids helps explain why mothers are superior when it comes to nurturing the young, especially infants and toddlers. Because they excel in reading or understanding their children, they're better able to provide their kids with what they need, from a snack to a hug, when they're in some type of distress, as the kids. Perhaps more importantly, there is considerable sociological and psychological evidence that moms are more emotionally attached to their children than are fathers. So the point is that mothers seem to be more invested in responding to their children's needs, and fathers are more likely to give their kids a measure of latitude. Why is this? Well, of course, there are many sociological reasons, but there's also growing biological evidence that mothers are primed by their hormones in part to engage in nurturing behaviors such as hugging, praising, or cuddling. Women have markedly higher levels of estrogen than do men, and estrogen is known to promote nurturing behavior in humans. The hormone oxytocin, which is released at high levels in women during pregnancy and breastfeeding, makes mothers more interested in bonding with children and engaging in nurturing behavior. In other words, not only are women better at nurturing, but they're also more likely to enjoy expending time and energy nurturing kids, particularly infants and toddlers. And children know this. Numerous studies indicate that infants and toddlers, especially, prefer their mothers to their fathers when they're seeking solace or relief from hunger, fear, sickness, or some other kind of distress. Mothers tend to be more soothing. For instance, one study done at Boston Children's Hospital found that infants relaxed when moms approached. Their pulse, their breathing rates, and their eyelids lowered when mom came along. In other words, when children are looking for comfort and consolation, No one compares to Mom. Next slide, please. So for all these reasons, it should not surprise us to find that, as Stanford psychology professor Eleanor McApee has observed, quote, in all known societies, women, whether they're working outside the home or not, assume most of the day-to-day responsibility for childcare, unquote. Or as Rutgers anthropologist Helen Fisher has said, quote, in every culture in the world where anthropologists have looked, in 168 societies, even where women are exceedingly economically powerful, women do the vast majority of the raising of the very small children. Women are interested in babies. They bear the babies. They've got the high levels of estrogen associated with the nurturing of the very young, unquote. So taken together, mom's comparative advantage in breastfeeding, understanding their children, communicating with their kids, and nurturing helps us to understand why it is the vast majority of societies organize the bulk of child rearing, especially around the very young, around the mother. This is indeed what we see on the ground in places as varied as Spain, South Africa, India, England, Canada, and Kentucky. Next slide. Although the distinctive talents that mothers bring to the child rearing enterprise are invaluable, dads also bring an array of distinctive talents to the parenting enterprise. I'm going to focus on four advantages that dads bring to family life. Specifically, dads excel when it comes to providing, disciplining, playing, and challenging their kids. And also when it comes, of course, to loving the mother of their children. Next slide, please. Money matters. We often forget this basic truth, but money matters for families when it comes to things like food, clothing, housing, and education. And at least in intact married families in the U.S., it's still the case that dads are more likely to focus or specialize more on providing than our moms. You can see here they earn about 2/3 of family income in intact families. So after kids come along, dads tend to do more work, moms tend to step back a little bit from the workforce, and that's why, in part, men tend to earn more income in the average home, even today, than do women. So clearly, dads make a real material contribution to the welfare of their family, one that we should not forget and that we should not minimize. Next slide. When it comes to discipline, although it is the case that moms discipline their kids more often than do fathers simply because they spend more time with their kids on average, dads have a comparative advantage in this area. Typically, fathers engender more fear than mothers in their kids because they have a comparative degree of physical strength and size, along with pitch and inflection of your voice, that telegraphs toughness to their kids. Compared to moms, dads are also more assertive in their dealings with their children and less likely to bend family rules or principles for their kids. In a word, dads tend to be firmer and more compelling disciplinarians than mothers. And this may be linked once again to testosterone. Consequently, dads are more likely than mothers to get their teenage boys to respond appropriately to their disciplinary strategy, both because of their uniquely firm approach to discipline and because boys seem more likely to respond to discipline from someone of the same sex. For all these reasons, dad's discipline plays a signal role in fostering an orderly climate in the home. Next slide. Dads also have an advantage when it comes to play. Although moms, once again, spend more time playing with their kids than do dads, the type of play that fathers engage in with their kids is distinctive. Fathers are much more likely to engage their infants, toddlers, and teens in vigorous, physical, and exciting forms of play and games. Dads are more likely than mothers to be found throwing their toddlers into the air or kicking a soccer ball with their teenage son. This vigorous style of play is important. Paternal play promotes social skills, intellectual development, and a sense of self-control. The playful side of fathers teaches their children how to regulate their feelings and their behaviors as they interact with others. engaging in rough physical play with dad teaches kids how to deal with aggressive impulses and physical contact without losing control of their emotions. For instance, one study found that father-child play taught kids to recognize others' emotions and to regulate their own emotions. As Emory psychologist John Sterry wrote, quote, "Children who roughhouse with their fathers usually quickly learn that biting, kicking, and other forms of physical violence are not acceptable," unquote. So kids who play more often with their father are even more popular in school, he found in his research, because they've learned some of these skills about how to regulate their behavior and their emotions in dealing with others from this playful interaction with dad. So in other words, the lessons that children learn playing with their fathers prepare them well for the game of life. Finally, fathers play a central role in pushing their kids to face the challenges and opportunities that confront them outside the home. Compared to moms, dads are more likely to encourage their kids to take up difficult tasks, to seek out novel experiences, and to endure pain and hardship without yielding. At a young age, fathers are more likely than mothers to encourage toddlers to engage in new activities, to interact with strangers, and to be independent. As kids enter adolescence, fathers are more likely to introduce children to the worlds of work, sports, and civil society. The bottom line is that fathers excel in teaching their children the virtues of fortitude, temperance, and prudence as they prepare for life outside the family. Or in the words of psychologist Daniel Paquette, quote, "Fathers seem to play an essential role in the empowerment of children and the opening of children to the outside world," unquote. Not surprisingly, there's considerable evidence that paternal involvement is associated with high rates of educational and occupational attainment, self-confidence, and pro-social behavior for boys and for girls. Okay, next slide here. But one of the most important influences that fathers can have on their kids is not direct, but rather it's indirect. That we know that dads who do a good job of loving the mother of their children are able to influence their kids through the mother of their kids. We know that moms who are happily married are more likely to be involved with their own children, to be nurturing or affectionate with their children, and to do a better job of keeping track of their children. And we also know that dads who treat the mother of their kids with respect and with affection are doing an important job in modeling good behavior both to their daughters and to their sons. In other words, they're more likely to be teaching their boys to deal with girls and women in a respectful manner, and they're more likely in this case to teach their daughters to expect to be treated well by the boys and the men that they encounter in their lives. So in all these ways, if fathers are good husbands, they're creating a climate of love and affection that redounds to the benefit of their kids. Next slide here. Now, I should say, just as a side note, that I was raised by a single mother here, and I think that she did a pretty good job in raising me. But I'm speaking to you today as a sociologist about kind of average patterns when it comes to kids' outcomes, and just sort of to bear in mind that there are exceptions, of course, to all these patterns when it comes to thinking about the impact of family structure on kids' lives. So research on parenting styles and family structure indicates that sex-differentiated parenting brings important benefits to children. A review of research on parenting and child development found that children of parents who engaged in sex-typical behavior, where the mother was more responsive and nurturing, and the father was more challenging and firm, were more competent than kids whose parents did not engage in sex-typical behavior. Another study of adolescents found that the best parenting approach was one in which moms were highly responsive and dads were highly demanding with their kids. And the research on family structure is also very suggestive. In general, kids who grow up outside of an intact married family are two to three times more likely to experience serious psychological, academic, or social problems compared to kids who grow up in single or in step families. The general tenor of this research can be illustrated by briefly considering what we know about fatherlessness and how it affects boys and girls. Next slide here. For boys, the link between crime and fatherlessness is very clear. As former U.S. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan observed, quote, "A community that allows a large number of young men to grow up in broken families, dominated by women, never acquiring any stable relationship to male authority, that community asks for and gets chaos." Boys learn self-control, as we have heard, from playing with and being disciplined by a loving father. As importantly, boys also learn to control their own aggressive instincts when they see a man that they respect and love, their father, handling frustration, conflict, and difficulty without resorting to violence. By contrast, boys who do not regularly experience the love, the discipline, and modeling of a good father are more likely to engage in what's called compensatory masculinity in the literature, where they reject and denigrate all that's feminine and instead seek to prove their masculinity by engaging in domineering and violent behavior. And studies of crime indicate that one of the strongest predictors of crime for boys is growing up in a home without a father. For instance, the slide up here shows what Princeton University sociologist Sarah McClanahan has found in one study. Namely, boys who are raised outside of a home with their father were more than twice as likely as boys raised by both their mom and dad to end up in prison before they turn 32, even after controlling for a range of factors like income, race, and education. Moreover, studies of crime and family patterns at the neighborhood level come to similar conclusions. As Harvard sociologist Robert Sampson observes, quote, "Family structure is one of the strongest, if not the strongest, predictors of variations of urban violence across cities in the United States." So the pointer simply is that dads matter both for individual kids and for the larger communities within which they live. Next slide. Clearly, dads play a central role in civilizing boys. They also play an important role, though, in civilizing girls, as the research on sexual promiscuity and teenage childbearing makes readily apparent. Fathers who are affectionate and firm with their daughters, who love and respect their wives, and who simply stick around, can play a crucial role in minimizing the likelihood that their daughters will become sexually active prior to marriage. The affection that dads bestow on their daughters makes those daughters less likely to seek attention from young men who don't have their best interests at heart. Dads also protect their daughters from premarital sex by setting clear limits for their daughters, by keeping abreast of their whereabouts, and by signaling to young men that sexual activity will not be tolerated. And finally, when they're in the home, research by University of Arizona psychology professor Bruce Ellis suggests that dads send a biological signal through their pheromones. These are special aromatic chemicals that are released from our bodies that may actually slow the sexual development of their daughters. And just as a side note, what he finds here is that girls who are in intact homes with their fathers have puberty at the latest ages, and that girls who are in a single parent home with just their mom have puberty at a younger age, and that girls who are living with an unrelated male, a boyfriend or a stepfather, have puberty at the earliest ages. And there's actually a clear parallel between this pattern among humans and among some of the primates that he's been studying too. So what he is suggesting here is something about these pheromones. It's communicating to girls that it's either time or not time to develop sexually, and it has consequences for their sexual activity and for their attractiveness to the opposite sex. So for all these reasons, girls who grow up in intact families are much less likely to experience puberty at an early age, to be sexually active before marriage, and to get pregnant before marriage. Indeed, the longer dads stick around, the less likely girls are to be sexually active prior to marriage. And this slide gives you kind of a sense of this pattern. What you can see here is it's particularly true for girls whose dads leave before they turn 6. They're much more likely to become sexually involved and to become pregnant as teens, as this slide suggests. So clearly, dads matter for girls in this important domain. Go to the next slide. Now, I could go through slides on you know, high school graduation, college graduation, you know, on depression to sort of illustrate a lot of these different points. But I wanted just to do one more slide that kind of gives you a sense of the empirical literature here, because I mentioned at the beginning of my talk the quote from Jennifer Aniston about basically dads being superfluous in connection with her new movie where she is portraying a single mom who uses sperm donation. What she is unaware of is that there's a new study out there which indicates that kids whose moms were single moms through sperm donation are much more likely to have a number of different problems, including to have a record of an encounter with law enforcement, on the left here on the slide, or on the right, to have a problem with substance abuse, even controlling for things like income, you know, education, race, and ethnicity. So the point simply is that across a wide range of domains in various family configurations, we're seeing that dads play an important role, and that kids who don't have access to their own fathers on a kind of day-in and day-out basis are more likely to suffer. Okay, the next slide. So our tour de force this afternoon of the social science on gender and parenthood indicates the following. The best psychological, sociological, and biological evidence to date suggests that on average, men and women bring different talents to the parenting enterprise, that children benefit from having parents with distinct parenting styles, that we ought to organize our families to take advantage of these distinct styles, and that family breakdown poses a serious threat to children and to the societies within which they live. Now, what do we do with this science? Well, I think we need to recognize that there will be some differences, you know, on average, in mothers' and fathers' approaches to parenting. Eleanor Maccabee, the distinguished feminist psychologist at Stanford University, who once championed the idea that sex differences were caused only by socialization, now acknowledges the importance of biology in explaining sex differences in parenting. In her latest book, The Two Sexes, she concludes her study of men and women by admitting that it's, quote, probably not realistic to set a 50-50 division of labor between fathers and mothers in the day-to-day care of children as the most desirable pattern toward which we should strive as a social goal. We should consider the alternative view that equity between the sexes does not have to mean exact equality in the sense of the two sexes having exactly the same lifestyles and exactly the same allocation of time, unquote. So, in other words, vive la différence, or live the difference. Next slide. So to conclude, I think we need to cast aside the California dreams of San Francisco and Hollywood elites and renew our appreciation for grandma's wisdom about marriage, motherhood, fatherhood, and children. Specifically, we should do more to strengthen marriage, recognizing that marriage is the institution that virtually all societies and all major civilizations have devised to ensure that children have the benefit of being reared by their mother and their father. And let me be very clear here, especially in this place, this is not an exclusively religious claim. This is a human claim. Marriage can be found in every major civilization in the world, precisely because every civilization in the world has recognized that children are more likely to thrive when they have the emotional, the social, and the financial support of both their mother and their father. So to conclude, let all of us in our own spheres, from churches to businesses to education to the home, do all that we can to ensure that our adolescents and our children have the good fortune of growing up with the man and the woman whose love brought them into this world, that is, with their own married mother and father. Thank you.
Same as last time, we'll take questions. You can start making your way to the mics. And I should mention, by the way, that someone asked me about this. He is a colleague of and was a student of James Davison Hunter, and you may have read his work on culture wars. What's the name of his new book? I've got it, and I'm drawing a blank.
I think it's called To Change the World.
To Change the World, yeah. And it's in our bookstore. And we thank you for that. Does this mean we should have a wise Latino woman? No, that's a whole different issue. Sorry. Go ahead.
In your lecture, you talked about how children being raised in a fatherless home has detrimental effects on them. Is there studies, or if a child is raised in a homosexual relationship, does that have a detrimental effect on their them too?
So the question is, what's the literature suggest on kids who are raised in same-sex households? And there are a couple of things. It's a very complex question that need to be said here. The first thing is that we have really nothing on kids who are raised by gay men, because those kids are very, very rare in the kind of the real world. So that's point number one. Point number two is, in terms of the literature on kids who are being raised by lesbians, the research to date suggests that there really is very little difference between those kids and kids who are raised in other households, with the exception of some differences when it comes to gender identity and their sexual orientation. There are some studies that suggest that there are some differences there. But there are two, I would say, sets of limitations associated with the current research on this particular question. One is that the vast majority of these studies have been used, or have been using, small, non-representative samples of parents. And so, speaking from a methodological perspective, we have to be careful about, you know, how we interpret these studies from a scientific perspective. The second point is that they've not focused on adolescents, by and large, and young adults. And I think we would expect that most of the effects of same-sex households be more manifest when kids are transitioning, you know, through and beyond puberty, entering into romantic and sexual relationships, entering into families. So that's where I think we might see some, obviously, some greater differences. And the final point that I would make is there is actually a decent literature, both from Europe and the United States, which suggests that lesbian households are much less stable than are not just heterosexual married households, but also gay households or gay couples. And when I initially came across this set of findings, I was kind of surprised, like, what's going on there? But it actually makes sense, because when you look at patterns of divorce in the U.S. among heterosexuals, what you see is that women in the U.S. are much more likely to initiate a divorce. Two-thirds of divorces are legally initiated by women, and most subjective reports would correspond to that basic kind of pattern. And part of that may be because men are more likely to engage in bad behavior, but it's also the case that women tend to have a much higher sort of capacity to kind of monitor all the ups and downs of their relationship, and they're more likely to, you know, to get out of a relationship if they don't think it's meeting their emotional needs. So we think what may be happening with lesbian couples is that they basically have two women who are both monitoring all the ups and downs of a relationship, and that's not a very stable, apparently, you know, context for a couple relationship. That's, I think, worth noting simply because the literature suggests that on average, kids thrive in a very stable family context. And so if lesbian households are not very stable, that may have implications, you know, down the road for kids' well-being. And just to finish up on my response to that question, it's important, too, to note that science tends to take some time in making assessments about family structure. It took us about 25 years to get a good handle on the effects of the no-fault divorce revolution on our kids in the U.S. And so what I would say is that we'll have a better sense as sociologists and as psychologists when it comes to assessing the impact of same-sex marriage and households on kids in about 15 years from now. So, yes, ma'am.
Hi, my question is about the effect that it has on children who grow up in single-father homes without a mother.
That's a great question, and partly because single dads are much less common than single moms, we don't have as much of a literature on that particular outcome. But, you know, basically we do find that some of the same risk factors that we associate with single motherhood are found among kids who are being raised by single dads. But there are some differences in the, you know, in the general pattern in terms of, you know, like the capacity, for instance, to commit in a romantic relationship, to sort of to be in communion with someone else. It seems to be less common among kids who are raised by a single father than by kids raised in an intact family or by a single mom. So there are risks that are similar across these two households, but also some that are distinctive for, you know, kids who are raised by single dads. So, yes, sir.
I was wondering if there was a differentiation between a physically present father and an emotionally present father. In my mind, I have two ideas, one of them being like the stay together for the kids attitude, and the other, like, if a father dies or leaves and then a stepfather comes in, is that the same as having your father?
So, well, actually you're raising a number of different issues which are all important, I think, to mention. One is that as long as the father is not, you know, abusive, his presence seems to have some value for, you know, for kids on average. But it's certainly the case that the more the father is engaged both practically and emotionally in the lives of his kids, the more likely it is that he'll have obviously a positive impact on his children. So that's, I guess that's point number one. Now, in terms of the issue of stepfathers, the literature there is pretty ambivalent. On the one hand, kids who are in a stepfamily context, which is usually with a stepfather, do better economically than kids who are in single mother households. And on some educational outcomes, they also do better, in part because they have access to a stepdad's financial resources. When it comes to their own romantic lives, their own future marriages, and the risk of sexual and physical abuse, kids who are in stepfamilies are at a greater risk than kids who are in stable single mother households. Because men who are not, you know, biologically related or related through adoption from infancy don't tend to form the same kinds of strong positive ties with their stepkids as do biological fathers, as do adoptive fathers who've kind of been there since, you know, since infancy. So the point simply is that the sort of story about stepdads is fairly ambiguous.
I want to thank you for being with us today. In your first response to the first question, you mentioned it may be another 15 years for the sociological data on homosexual couples to have any influence on the discussion. And my question is related to culturally viable arguments against same-sex marriage. Think about the parallel with abortion. We can make a case from a religious perspective it's wrong to abort a baby and to commit murder, but at the same time we can hook a pregnant mother up to an ultrasound and let her listen to the heartbeat, and she knows that's a life and it's wrong to take a life. It's a culturally appealing argument. My question is, what kinds of arguments or strategies can be used prior to that sociological data really being able to argue for or against same-sex marriage that can be culturally compelling and not just resort only to religious arguments that may not be embraced by the culture at large?
Well, I think, you know, for obvious reasons, it's a pretty difficult task these days. But, you know, what I would suggest is that most things that I've said today are, actually everything that I've said today is not based upon a specifically religious worldview. So we can, I think, sort of rehearse basically the ideas of sort of average differences between, you know, men and women, and how they are implicated in the success of the parenting enterprise. But beyond that particular point, I think it's also important to note that there is, you know, evidence from studies of kids who've been adopted and from this new study that I mentioned in terms of sperm donation, that it's not just the gender of the parent that matters, it's the biological relationship of the parent to the child that matters. So as we can kind of go beyond the assertion by the judge in San Francisco, Vaughn Walker, about gender being irrelevant for parenting and say, well, okay, let's just grant that for the sake of argument that that's true. I mean, I don't think it is, but let's just say it is true. It's still the case that there's a good body of research on kids who've been adopted and kids who've been conceived through sperm donation that it matters to be in a relationship with your own biological married mother and father. And I say this as someone who's adopted 5 kids, and it's a painful thing for me to acknowledge, but it's in the science that kids, generally speaking, do better when they're raised by their own biological mother and father. And so I think it's another point to kind of raise in public about, you know, basically most people would prefer to be in touch and to be raised by their own, you know, their own biological kin. And that's something that necessarily is not possible for same-sex couples. So I'm saying there are a variety of different fronts that people can, I think, raise issues and concerns that are thoroughly secular and not at all, you know, religious in any capacity or any form.
So if I can just ask a follow-up on that, how do we present those types of arguments in such a way that they're more compelling than the kind of swelling cultural perception that this is the civil rights movement of our day, that the right for gays to marry one another is more important than those type of things? How do you offset that type of argument with those?
Well, the public's attitudes are moving in two different directions, or they kind of have moved in two different directions. On the one hand, if you talk about the sort of adults and relationships, the public is moving in the direction of accepting same-sex relationships. And I don't think we're going to be able to reverse that or change that in any way, you know, at least in the near-term future. But if you look at public attitudes towards kids, the vast majority of the public still believes the best place for a child is with his mother and his father, with her mother and her father, in an intact family. So what I would say is that sort of the public argument could be we need to distinguish between adult desires and children's needs. And this is actually something that has happened already in parts of Europe where they have a fairly laissez-faire approach to same-sex relationships, but they do actually stress the importance of kids having moms and dads when it comes to something like adoption, for instance, in France. So I think the point I would make is that we should focus, you know, our rhetorical sort of fire, if you will, on the issue of what's the best place for the bearing and rearing of children. Yes, go ahead.
This is just clarification of a detail. Could you repeat the name of the female author you mentioned at the end who's done the work on the root of sexual differences?
So Eleanor Maccabee, who is a professor of psychology emerita at Stanford, was one of the leading feminist psychologists who would argue that sex differences were primarily caused by socialization, and she has since come around to the idea that there's basically both a biological and a social influence that helps to account for sex differences between both kids and adults.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Dr. Wilcox, you've touched on this a little bit, but could you maybe discuss a way to handle the physical disadvantages that you mentioned for parents who adopt, the physical advantages that a father would have to in raising a biological child versus, you said, the disadvantages in adoption,
right.
And how's a way to kind of be progressive in that, and what are some suggestions
sure.
that you could give to those of us who are planning on doing something like that in the future?
Well, you know, I think part of the in terms of this issue is about adoption. I mean, how do we, you know, kind of move beyond this, in a sense, this difficulty that we see among not all, but certainly some adoptive kids when it comes to their sense of their identity as a member of an adoptive family that's distant from their biological kin, sort of their place in the world, who their kin is, sometimes even their sort of national origin, et cetera. And I think one thing that's important for us to do at the starting point here is to just acknowledge this reality. So once we can't paper over that reality that, you know, for adopted kids, not for all, but for many of them, it's going to be, there is some pain there. And not to try to just ignore it or sweep it under the rug, but just to be honest about acknowledging that and trying to give as much comfort and consolation as we can to our adoptive kids if we have them. And the second thing I think is to be intentional about, you know, being prepared for the challenges that adoption can pose, doesn't always pose, but can challenge when it comes to kids' behavior and their emotions, particularly as they transition from their family of origin or their place of origin to their adoptive family. And there's going to be some hurdles that parents confront, and that they need to be prepared for those hurdles, need to be prepared for you know, the behavior and the emotions of their children as much as possible, and to commit to you know, to one another as parents, to handling them in a reasonable fashion and an affectionate fashion. And also, I would say the third point, I guess I would say, is that it's important, too, to seek out other adoptive parents who've kind of gone before you and have worked through some of the challenges and the joys of being an adoptive parent, and get some of their both wisdom and their kind of, you know, emotional and spiritual support, you know, as an adoptive parent. So that's what I would say.
I really appreciated the talk on the importance of the father loving the wife as an example for the children. In your research, have you seen a tendency for fathers to begin to neglect the importance of being a husband first? And if so, how can we guard against that? Or do you think there is a need to begin guarding against that?
It's a great question. I think among many contemporary couples, there's this kind of weird transition where they go from being totally focused on one another to being totally focused on their kids. And they've got, you know, piano lessons and soccer practice and, you know, tutoring and, you know, yada, 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 yada. And, of course, the problem with that is that their marriage can suffer. It's true for both dads and for moms. And so I think it's important for for parents to realize that they need to set aside some time and some emotional energy for their marriage, and that's crucial in kind of feeding the marriage and the family life more generally for reasons that I mentioned in this talk, and that in today's sort of helicopter parenting world, particularly for more affluent, educated parents, the marriage itself can suffer, and we need to sort of work against that. So, how about just one more question from this gentleman over here?
Thank you for coming today. My question is there an age that you've noticed where it is particularly paramount for a child to have this attachment to a mother and father? In the situation I'm in, we are adopting a five-year-old, and he came from a family where it was just with his mother, and he is very clingy and not very independent, which kind of leans on the data that you've given us.
Right.
Is that the age where it's particularly important for them to have that attachment, or have you been across anything?
Well, I would just sort of say that in general, that basically dads can impact their kids at any age, but I would say particularly as they kind of move sort of through and beyond the toddler stage. But sort of the interaction that takes place between a father and his kids, is going to change necessarily across the life course. There's not one point in time that I would say is most important. What I would say in the context that you're talking about is just that I think the bigger point here is that when you adopt a child, you have to kind of be patient and sort of in understanding that oftentimes it takes a while for that child to kind of get used to the new family context and to kind of move into a more developmentally appropriate sequence of behavior, and that really the important thing is to be patient and to be as loving as you possibly can, in that context, recognizing that it's going to take a while for that child to kind of feel secure and at home in this new family context, and then you have to establish that emotional security with that child, that strong emotional base, and then you can move on to kind of working on some of these other issues that might be of concern to you. So.
By the way, some of you have mentioned Thomism. I've heard the word here and there. This is a feature of Thomism, that you would say that you have general revelation in nature and creation and natural law, and then you have special revelation in the Word of God and divine law. And by Thomas's understanding, they complement one another. So this is grist for the Christian's mill, the sociological study, and the Bible speaks together. For example, nature would say homosexuality is unnatural. Romans 1 says it's unnatural, and there's a nice accord. And I think I read somewhere that the chemicals that you mentioned, like with the onset of puberty, are even connected with a certain repellence against, it's against incest, that there's something that signals like this is not an appropriate deal, even if you don't know who the father is or something like this. One last quick question, manliness. There's a book by, is it Mansfield? Yale University Press, and he says the essence of manliness is being willing to sacrifice yourself for a woman or something like that. What about manliness, if we're short of that, just to close with this?
a small question.
A small thing, yeah. But these men are desperately wanting to, they're actually very manly, but just to fine tune.
Well, I think from my reading in psychology and sociology and anthropology, what I would say is that what seems to be a recurrent theme is that if you want men to kind of invest in families and churches and communities, you need to think about two things. One is sacrifice, and two is status. That basically men get status for, and respect, of course, for engaging in sacrificial behavior. But if you can kind of link those things together in a kind of a pro-social way, to speak in a more Thomistic, fashion, that on average you'll find that men are more likely to engage in their families, in their religious communities, and in their broader, communities. And then when we fail to accord the right kind of status to the right kind of sacrifices, we get the kinds of problems that we see in many communities now in this country.
Great. Dr. Wilcox, thanks for your scholarship and for bringing it to us today. We've got a lot to chew on here. Thank you for coming our way.